Support for this program comes from the Morris Bookshop, proud sponsor of the 2014 Kentucky Writers Hall of Fame induction ceremony broadcast. Morris Bookshop carries books by Hall of Fame authors in-store or online at morrisbookshop.com. And the Pfister Group at Morgan Stanley, 444 East Main Street in Lexington. Investments and services are offered through Morgan Stanley Smith Barney LLC. Details from Morgan or Justin Pfister at 859-231-9510. Member SIPC.
A celebration of Kentucky's greatest writers.
Thomas Merton.
If only they could all see themselves as they really are, there would be no more war, no more hatred, no more cruelty, no more greed. I suppose the big problem would be that we would fall down and worship each other.
Etheridge Knight.
Compose a verse for Malcolm, man, and make it rhyme and make it prim. The verse will die as all men do, but not the memory of him.
Rebecca Cottle.
Silence proclaimed the grief of my father and the warmth of the neighborly understanding that sustained him. Their duties finished, my father and his neighbors returned, each to his own home, leaving beneath the little mound not only the cold, lifeless body of my sister, but a part of my father as well.
On a bitterly cold winter evening in Lexington, Kentucky, seven distinguished authors were inducted into the Kentucky Writers Hall of Fame in a special ceremony at the Carnegie Center on January 23, 2014. During this hour, we'll present a recording of that ceremony and hear readings of the works of each of the seven new Hall of Fame inductees. And here is our host and guide for the ceremonies, Carnegie Center Director Neil Chethick.
Last year, we inducted the inaugural class, and that was Harriet Arnault, William Wells Brown, Harry Caudill, Elizabeth Maddox Roberts, James Still, and Robert Penn Warren. We've had an amazing run of Kentucky writers since 1800 or so, and I would say we're actually picking up steam. A few of the readers who you will hear tonight are some of our new emerging young writers, people who are maybe someday going to be in this Hall of Fame. So this year, as you know, we've identified 13 finalists, and tonight, seven of them will be inducted. Like last year, all the inductees must have met three criteria. They must be deceased, they must be connected to Kentucky in a significant way, and they must be the authors of published works of enduring quality. Beyond that, it's a completely subjective process. And I say that, well, I'll say a little more about that. This year, about 200 people were involved in the process, and it starts every September with a call to the public for nominees. We had about 70 nominees this year, individual, but many more people, you know, sent in the same names over and over again. Then we turned it over to a committee headed by Lori Meadows, who is here from the Kentucky Arts Council. And then they made recommendations to a committee that created the Hall of Fame here last year. So this year, I argued, as people will in the room will tell you, long and hard for Hunter Thompson, and spoiler alert, he did not make it. So all of you Hunter Thompson fans, hang on. I was bummed out, but then I went and I read those other seven who are in, and I can say that I am supportive of every last one of them. I think their work is fantastic, and I know we Hunter Thompson fans will have our day. So here's how this evening is going to work. I'm going to start down there in just a moment, and I'll give you a brief biography of each inductee, and then I'll name that writer. One of the Carnegie employees will remove the veil, and you'll see a portrait of this person, and then I will invite a contemporary writer, a Kentucky writer, who will have chosen already a short excerpt, and will read that to us. All right, now on to the honorees. The first 2014 inductee in the Kentucky Writers Hall of Fame, is also the Hall of Fame's first children's author. She was born in 1899 in Harlan County, and in her young adulthood, she was a teacher. And she did not publish her first book until she was 44 years old. But from then until her death in 1985, she wrote 21 more books. Many of them focused on pioneer life in Appalachia. In 1949, she wrote a middle grade book called Tree of Freedom, which was a Newbery Honor book. 15 years later, her picture book, A Pocket Full of Cricket, was a Caldecott Honor book. She spent much of her adult life in Illinois, where they now give an annual award in her name for the most popular middle grade book as voted on by those middle graders themselves. She once said, "The first essential in any book is that it have something significant to say. A good book sticks to your ribs." The first inductee into the Kentucky Writers Hall of Fame is Harlan County children's writer Rebecca Caudle. To read an excerpt from Rebecca Caudle's work this evening, we have an outstanding Lexington children's author, Marcia Thornton Jones. If you don't know Marcia's name, you might know her work, or your children might. She has published more than 130 books for children. There are 43 million copies in print. She's the co-author of 7 popular series, including The Adventures of the Bailey School Kids. She also mentors here. She mentors children's book writers here at the Carnegie Center. Please welcome Marcia Thornton Jones.
Thank you. This is from "Did You Carry the Flag Today, Charlie?" Charlie looked up at the Appalachian Mountains, towering all around him, gauzy green in the heat, splashed with the dark green of pines. He remembered the day he and Uncle Hawk had climbed to the tip top of the fire tower on Pilot Knob, where they could see mountain peaks going on, and the sky, like an upturned bowl, rimming them in. Down the notch between every two peaks, Uncle Hawk told Charlie, ran a trickle of water. There must be 1,000 licks and branches and creeks, Uncle Hawk reckoned, and every one of them had a name, just as every boy has a name. Grapevine and Cotton Patch, Wild Dog and Wolf, Sugar and Salt, Cutson and Betty Troublesome, and Granny Dismal. One day, thought Charlie, he'd climb to the top of one of those peaks, and he'd find where the trickle of water started. Rebecca Caudle had a knack for capturing the essence of characters and their worlds. I kind of think that maybe it's because she had such a strong connection to her own Kentucky heritage. This is from My Appalachia, a reminiscence. My twin sister and I, so I have been told, were assisted on our arduous journey into life by a midwife, Usley Boggs. The event took place at Poor Fort, Kentucky, on a bitter cold night in early February. 3 days later, my sister died. My father hammered together a coffin of pine boards in which to bury my sister and covered it with black cambric. One of our neighbors, Cassie Huff, came across our pasture bringing with her a tiny dress and a dainty pillow of soft white mull together with a length of the same material. With the length of mull, she made for my sister's coffin a lining, gathering the material into a softness at the bottom and around the sides. Then she laid the pillow in the coffin for my sister's head to rest on and prepared my sister for burial. My father laid my sister in the black sheath coffin gently, as if he feared he might disturb her last long sleep. Then he nailed the cover on the coffin, lifted the burden to his shoulder, and, bearing a much heavier burden within himself, set out across the Poor Fork River on the ice for the Sandhill graveyard on the opposite side. Neighbor men had already dug a grave, such a little grave, in which to lay the coffin. Respectfully and silently, they stood and watched my father lay his child in the grave. Then my father stood with head bowed while the neighbors shoveled earth on the coffin, gently and quietly. When they had rounded the earth into a mound, my father brought a small field stone and placed it upright at the head of the grave. A smaller stone he placed at the foot of the grave. No hymn was sung, no prayer uttered, no words spoken. Silence proclaimed the grief of my father and the warmth of the neighborly understanding that sustained him. Their duties finished, my father and his neighbors returned, each to his own home, leaving beneath the little mound not only the cold, lifeless body of my sister, but a part of my father as well.
Thank you, Marcia. Our next inductee was born in Mississippi in 1903. After working in his teen years on farms and boats and sawmills, he decided to get educated, and he didn't stop until he had earned his doctorate in history at Duke University. Then he got smart and moved to UK. And for the next 7 decades, he taught, researched, archived, collaborated, and wrote. His first book was published in 1933, his last in 2002. Most were about this state, including A History of Kentucky and Kentucky, Land of Contrast. He helped found the University Press of Kentucky, the Kentucky History Center, and the Lexington History Museum before his death in 2005 at the age of 101. His widow, Loretta, unfortunately couldn't be here this evening. She was planning to, but she had to come from Louisville and she couldn't, but she wanted me to send her regards, and she's said that she was tremendously honored to have her husband go into the Hall of Fame. Our second inductee in the Writers Hall of Fame is Thomas D. Clark. To read an excerpt from Dr. Clark's work today, we have Dr. James Clotter. Dr. Clotter received his PhD in history from the University of Kentucky. He is the prize-winning author of, or co-author and editor of 18 books. He served as director of the Kentucky Historical Society and is now a professor of history at Georgetown College and is the state historian of Kentucky. He recently finished a book on Henry Clay and the American presidency. Please welcome Dr. James Clotter.
Thanks, Neil. As you can tell, I'm not one of the young authors that Neil was talking about. Although Dr. Clark called me young Jim Clotter always. I was young compared to him, so. You know, a poet once noted, of all the arts in which the wise excel, nature's chief masterpiece is writing well. Well, Dr. Clark wrote well in about 30 books, and it makes it very hard to pick his selections up here. You know, you pick something that includes some of his comments on minor matters. For instance, in one of his books, he wrote about beaten biscuits. He said, "There are few combinations which they can be used with any degree of success." But my choices reflect two other things. Dr. Clark's ability to say a lot in a few words. One of them's about country stores. It's from the book Pills, Petticoats, and Plows, which I still think is one of his best books about the country, Southern country store. And it starts, he's talking about they've taken their cotton crop from his native Mississippi. They've taken their cotton crop to market. They've sold it. They're coming home with goods now for the first time. Hunched over a spring seat, a cotton farmer jolted homeward behind a jaded pair of mules with a can of kerosene, a hunk of meat, a pail of compound lard, and dust-covered bags of flour and meal. This was the store diet and transport. At home, wives sliced off thick slices of the Iowa meat and fried it for breakfast. Boiled hunks of it for dinner, fried more of it for supper. They thickened the gravy with flour and served it and molasses as sop for cornbread and biscuits. 3 times a day and 52 weeks a year, for many, was a monotonous year of meat, cornbread, biscuit, gravy, and molasses. And then he says, life for most of the customers of the country store was of a marked degree of whiteness. There was white meat, white gravy, white bread, white shortening for the table, white supremacy at the polls, and white glove for the pallbearer at the gravesite. Says a lot in just the little words there. The other one is from his book, His History of Kentucky, that was mentioned, his 1937 history that was the dominant history of the state for 60 years. I wish my books would last that long. And here he's talking about the contemporary Kentuckian, He's writing in 1937 about the Kentuckians of 1930s that he knew at the time. He'd been in the state about 8 years by then. In his own mind, the contemporary Kentuckian is convinced that no other section compares favorably with his own. When a stranger is introduced, he is asked, "Are you a native Kentuckian?" If he is a native son, he's accepted on grounds of mutual understanding. But if not, the Kentuckian will recite Kentucky's traditions and history. History to the average Kentuckian, however, does not mean that his state was one of the first settlements in the West, or that it became an important commercial link between the North and the South. Instead, the history of Kentucky to the native son is a personal matter. It is not uncommon for a visitor to gather for a conversation with a local historian of a remote Kentucky village, a feeling that all civilization had its real start and that all in his village, all of the events of national history had their beginning there. And then he says at the end, "A pronounced state character has lent glamour and distinction to Kentuckians. Their home state with its history and tradition is their cherished possession. To a native son, there is no more musical name in the English language than Kentucky. He uses it not only as a noun, but also as an adjective. There are Kentucky hams, beaten biscuits, mint juleps, bean soup, kernels, lambs, whiskey, horses, rifles, feuds, and other products of peculiar value that only a Kentucky can give them." Right. And I would just note, you know, Tom Clark was 5 months old when the first plane flew at Kitty Hawk. You know, that plane is now in a museum, immobile. His words, though, still soar. Thanks.
Wow, that's fantastic. Our next inductee was born in 1905 in Arkansas, and was, like Rebecca Caudle, the daughter of two teachers. In her mid-30s, she moved to Frankfort, Kentucky for a job, and then soon after to Louisville. And then in 1949, at the age of 44, she published her first piece of fiction entitled The Enduring Hills. Notice that was the exact same age that Rebecca Caudle published her first. So I think a lot of writers, women writers during that time, were discouraged from writing until came out of them. That same year, 1949, she moved with her husband to his family's land in Adair County, near the Kentucky-Tennessee border. And over the next quarter century, she wrote or co-wrote 24 books, including The Kentuckians, Hannah Fowler, and The Believers, all focused on 19th century life in Kentucky. After her and her husband's deaths, friends and fans in Adair County created a society to preserve the couple's literary legacy and also to restore their log home. And two of those folks are here today. Five of you are here today. Fantastic. Several, at least one or two, have driven all the way from Adair County to be here tonight, so we appreciate that very much. And feel free to talk to them about that society. I'm sure they'll accept contributions. So our third inductee tonight in the Kentucky Writers Hall of Fame is Janice Holt Giles. Did Crystal make it? I wasn't sure whether she was going to be here, so I have a backup just in case. And I appreciate Katarina Klamer stepping in the moment to read a piece from Janice Holt Giles.
Hi, everyone. I will read to you from The Believers. My name is Rebecca Fowler. I grew up in Lincoln County on the Hanging Fork of Dix River. I was the third child, the second daughter of Hannah and Matthias Fowler, being born to them in the spring of 1783. Richard always said I was a handsome woman. I do not know about that, but it's true that I am tall, though not as tall as my mother, and strongly built as she was, with her same dark hair and eyes. Great physical endurance came to me from her also, and if it is true that I have always had a very level way of looking at things, that too came from her, for I never knew her not to be sensible and wise. The home on the Hanging Fork was a pleasant one, with enough of the world's goods for comfort and with friends and neighbors settled all about. There was an older sister, Jane, who was very like my father, with fair skin and reddish-brown hair, and there were three brothers, one older than I, two younger. We were put to tasks very early. When I was as young as 5, I did my stint on the winter knitting, and I could turn the big spinning wheel to fill a spindle as evenly as my mother before I was 10. I learned to weave, to help with the stock, to work in the garden patch, and to take my portion of the care of the house, all at a very tender age. I count it excellent training for any woman. My mother and father were strict with us, but not stern. They expected and exacted obedience, but I have always thought that discipline commenced early surrounds a child with safe limits for his growing up. We had as many pleasures as the times accorded. We went occasionally to spend the day with neighbors. We went to corn huskings and barn raisings and to quilting bees. We were taken sometimes to the county seat town, and once even my father took us the long journey to Lexington. It was a marvel for our young eyes to see the city, and always after the church was organized, we went to meeting, for both my mother and my father were faithful Presbyterians. And we had more schooling than most young ones of our station. A traveling Englishman stayed with us 2 winters. He was studying the ways of the birds and the animals of our country, and he carried a great lot of books with him. He also painted many of the things we studied. He was a fine gentleman, and he taught us in return for his bed and board, even my mother and father learning under him. He read to us from his books and taught us from them. He was thorough and in his teaching too, so that we can all write a fine hand and have some understanding of rhetoric, grammar, literature, geography, and history.
If you ever want to know what it's like, what it was like to live at Shaker Village when it was a thriving community, that's the book, The Believers. Our fourth inductee was born in Lexington in 1935. He attended Henry Clay High School, where he lettered in 4 sports, worked on his car, and according to his wife, showed little or no attraction to literature. He then attended the University of Kentucky, eventually finding his way to the English department. After graduating, he won the prestigious Wallace Stegner Fellowship in Creative Writing at Stanford University, 1 of 4 in a row from Kentucky. When he was 26, he published his first novel, Yates Paul, His Grand Flights, His Tootings, and continued to write and publish short fiction in the Saturday Evening Post, Kenyon, and many other periodicals. His writing life always coexisted with his interest in photography. He was a serious photographer and wrote about photography for Aperture and Esquire magazines. He returned to UK in 1973, and then he directed the creative writing program for more than 30 years. And during this time, in addition to mentoring hundreds of young writers, he produced another novel, a novel in verse, and 6 volumes of poetry. He served as Kentucky's Poet Laureate from 2001 to 2003. and he died in 2009. For the last 30 years of his life, he lived on a farm on the Harrison County line with his wife, Mary Ann Taylor Hall, who's here tonight with many of other family members. The fourth inductee tonight in the Hall of Fame is the legendary poet and professor, James Baker Hall. To read an excerpt from Hall's work, we have Sarah Wiley Van Meter. Sarah Wiley met Jim in a writing workshop at UK, where she was earning degrees in English and photography. She became Hall's photography assistant in 2001 and worked with him until he closed his studio. She's a filmmaker. She co-created Elbow of Light, a film on James Baker Hall. And she's the manager for the James Baker Hall Archive of Photographs and Films. Please welcome Sarah Wiley.
These two poems are from Stopping on the Edge to Wave. Sitting between two mirrors. What I like best is making lists of what I like best. The good days are inventories, near and far. I seldom leave without a book. Where would I go without a book? You would say my life is a lottery, that I am the only one without a ticket. You would say your life is better. You say it over and over. You do. What do? I put things in boxes. I move boxes around. I have many things, some of them mine. I care for them. This is what I do. I do simple things. I move them around, clearing places to move them around. I tell you I do things over and over. Now you tell me something. Talk is what you do. It comforts me to hear you talk. You would say you are mine too, my not simple thing. Say it again, today. I want to hear you say something, today. I wash your clothes. I buy you fresh bread. I get the paper to see what day it is. I laugh. I act as though I know what day it is. I laugh again. It comforts me to hear you talk. I talk on the phone. I water the plants while I talk on the phone. I make coffee while I talk on the phone. I am a person like anyone else. I act like a person. A person calls and says whatever it is a person says today. A person says today. I say today over and over, getting it straight. Getting it straight is what I do. I want to get it straight. I say, what did you say? Tell me something again. Comfort me. Today? Yes, today. Is that it? And when is that? That first kite, in memory of Ralph Eugene Meatyard. That first kite was made of newspaper and strung with fish line. I was lying next to it alone. Sunlight in the bright shape of a window, X'd once with the shadow of the sash, moved slowly across the floor toward me. A way had to be found to make it work. We were trying. All this took place in the attic where the cat brought the birds. My mother was downstairs or out back in the cornfield with a gun. I didn't move. Who knew where my father was? Nothing ever worked. I kept my eyes closed whenever I thought I was asleep or flying. I awoke when I felt the light touch my feet. Perfect. Still, I didn't move. When it touched my eyes, I opened. The crosshairs were on my chest, breathing. I saw my heart. A cold wind rattled the kite.
Now we have a special treat. That last poem, that first kite, a few years ago, Sarah Wiley was making that film about James Baker Hall and wanted some music and asked if Warren Byram, a local musician, could turn that into music. And he did, and he's here tonight to play that song, Warren Byram.
That first kite was made of newspaper and strong with fish line. I was lying next to it alone. Sunlight and the bright shape of a window. Etched once in the shadow of a sash. Moves slowly across the floor toward me. A way had to be found to make it work. We were trying. All this took place in the attic, where the cat brought the bird. My mother was downstairs, or out back in the cornfield with a gun. And I didn't move. Who knew where my father was? Nothing ever worked. Kept my eyes closed whenever I thought I was asleep or flying. I woke when the light touched my feet. Perfect. Still, I didn't move. When it touched my eyes, I opened. Crosshairs were on my chest. Crosshairs were on my chest, breathing. I saw my heart, and a cold wind rattled the kite. The
2014 Kentucky Writers Hall of Fame ceremony from Lexington's Carnegie Center continues in a moment.
Sir, I am a farmer singing at the plow, and as I take my time to plow along a steep Kentucky hill, I sing my song, A One-Horse Farmer Singing at the Plow.
Stay with us.
Support for this program comes from the Morris Bookshop, proud sponsor of the 2014 Kentucky Writers Hall of Fame induction ceremony broadcast. Morris Bookshop carries books by Hall of Fame authors in-store or online at morrisbookshop.com. And the Pfister Group at Morgan Stanley, 444 East Main Street in Lexington. Investments and services are offered through Morgan Stanley Smith Barney, LLC. Details from Morgan or Justin Pfister at 859-231-9510. Member SIPC.
Thank you.
Here once again is your host for this broadcast of the 2014 Kentucky Writers Hall of Fame ceremony, Carnegie Center Director Neil Chethick.
Every movement needs a poet, and our next inductee is one of the enduring voices of the Black Arts Movement, the poetic complement to the Black Power Movement of the 1960s. He was born in Mississippi in 1931, and at about age 8, moved with his family to Paducah, where he spent most of the rest of his childhood. He dropped out of school at 16, joined the Army, fought in Korea, where he was wounded and became addicted to drugs. To support his habit, he stole money from a convenience store and spent nearly all of the 1960s in prison. His first book, Poems from Prison, was published while he was still an inmate, and it speaks to the tragedy that he saw of incarcerated Black men. After his release from prison, he continued to write. He earned Pulitzer Prize and National Book Award nominations for his 1973 volume of mostly love poems, Belly Song. He won a Guggenheim, he received honors from the Guggenheim and from the National Endowment for the Arts. He served as writer in residence at the University of Pittsburgh and at the University of Hartford, even though he didn't earn his bachelor's degree until he was 58 years old. A year later, in 1991, at the age of 59, he died of lung cancer. The fifth inductee into the Kentucky Writers Hall of Fame is the poet Etheridge Knight. To read from Knight's work, we have Jude McPherson. Jude asked that I introduce him only as an Appalachian poet who was greatly influenced by Etheridge Knight. And I'll add that we recently added Jude to the staff of the Carnegie Center. Please welcome Jude McPherson.
What's good? Week, come on now, what's good? All right, I chose this poem because the subject of it's another hero of mine that had a great influence on my thinking. This is for Malcolm, a year after. It's written for Malcolm X. Composed for red, a proper verse. Adhere to foot and strict I am. Control the burst of angry words, or they might boil and break the dam. Or they might boil and overflow, and drench me, drown me, drive me mad. So swear no oath, so shed no tear, and sing no song, Blue Baptist sad. Evoke no image, stir no flame, and spin no yarn across the air. Make empty Anglo tea lace words, make them dead white and dry bone bare. Compose a verse for Malcolm, man, and make it rhyme and make it prim. The verse will die as all men do, but not the memory of him. Death might come singing sweet like sea, or knocking like the old folks say. The moon and stars may pass away, but not the anger of that day. This last poem, when Neil asked me if I wanted to do this, like jumped at it, it's an honor. If you ask a poet what's their favorite poem, I mean, they just like, what the hell, man? But I can honestly say this is like one of my favorite poems I've ever read. It still just leaves me just in awe. It's called As You Leave Me. Shiny record album scattered over the living room floor, reflecting light from the lamp, sharp reflections that hurt my eyes as I watch you. Squatting among the platters, the beer foam making mustaches on your lips. And two, the shadows on your cheeks from your long lashes fascinate me almost as much as the dimples in your cheeks, your arms, and your legs. You hum along with Mathis. How you love Mathis with his burnished hair and quicksilver voice that dances among the stars and whirls through canyons like windblown snow. Sometimes I think that Mathis could take you from me if you could be complete without me. I glance at my watch. It is now time. You rise silently into the bedroom and the paint, on the lips red, on the eyes black. And I lean in the doorway and smoke and see you grow old before my eyes and smoke. Why do you chatter while you dress and smile when you grab your large leather purse? Don't you know that when you leave me, I walk to the window and watch you and light a reefer as I watch you, and I die as I watch you disappear in the dark streets to whistle and smile at the Johns. Thank you.
Thank you, Jude. The sixth inductee into the Hall of Fame is the only member thus far who is not native to the United States. He was born in France in 1915. By his 17th birthday, he had suffered the loss of both of his parents. He moved permanently to the United States a couple of years later, attended Columbia University, had a spiritual crisis, converted to Catholicism, and in 1941, at the age of 26, entered the Abbey of Our Lady of Gethsemane in Kentucky and became a Trappist monk. In 1948, while at Gethsemane, he published The Seven Story Mountain, a memoir of his early life and conversion. It became a bestseller. He went on to become arguably the most important Catholic writer of the 20th century, transitioning from a fundamentalist Catholic and ascetic, uninterested in the material world, to an anti-war activist and champion of inter-religious dialogue. In 1968, he traveled to Thailand for a conference and was electrocuted by a faulty wire in his hotel room. He died, in fact, on the 27th anniversary of his entrance into Gethsemane. His papers now reside at Bellarmine University in Louisville. The sixth new member of the Hall of Fame is Thomas Merton. To read Merton, we have Eric Ries. Eric grew up in Louisville and studied at the University of Kentucky, and he's now a UK Associate Professor of English. He's the author of An American Gospel and Lost Mountain, and he has written for Harper's, Orion, The New York Times, and many other publications. By coincidence, when I called to ask if he'd read from Merton tonight, he told me that he had just finished writing a chapter on Merton for a not-yet-published book on the utopian movement in America. That book will be called Utopia Drive, A Road Trip Through America's Most Radical Idea. I can't wait to read it. Here's Eric Ries.
I want to read a passage from Merton's journals. Everybody loves the seven-story mountain, but the genius of Merton is in the journals. This is about an epiphany Merton had at the corner of 4th and Walnut Street in Louisville. I went around, just to set the scene, I drove around this corner every day on my way to high school. And it was a gritty corner. There was a place called the San Antonio Inn, and it just said, like, hourly rates. So it was like, Gurney Norman would say it was a place that had texture. So this was a place that had texture. While I was in school, they changed the name of Walnut Street to Muhammad Ali Boulevard, and which I thought was great because it meant that the Walnut Street Baptist Church would have to become the Muhammad Ali Boulevard Baptist Church, which Merton would have loved that. That would have absolutely pleased Merton, but that didn't happen. So this is a passage from Merton's journal, and I just want to preface it with two sentences that are also from the journal. And these are two sentences that I have thought about for the last 25 years. The thing that we have to face is that life is as simple as this. We are living in a world that is absolutely transparent, and God is shining through it all the time. In Louisville, at the corner of 4th and Walnut, in the center of the shopping district, I was suddenly overwhelmed with the realization that I loved all these people, that they were mine and I theirs, that we could not be alien to one another, even though we were total strangers. It was like waking from a dream of separateness, of spurious self-isolation in a special world, the world of renunciation and supposed holiness. The whole illusion of a separate holy existence is a dream. Not that I question the reality of my vocation or of my monastic life, but the conception of separation from the world that we have in the monastery too easily presents itself as complete illusion. The illusion that by making vows, we become a different species of being, pseudo-angels, spiritual men, men of interior life, what have you. Certainly, these traditional values are very real. But their reality is not of an order outside everyday existence in a contingent world, nor does it entitle one to despise the secular. Though out of the world, we are in the same world as everybody else, the world of the bomb, the world of race hatred, the world of technology, the world of mass media, big business, revolution, and all the rest. We take a different attitude to all these things, for we belong to God. Yet so does everybody else belong to God. We just happen to be conscious of it and to make a profession of this consciousness. But does that entitle us to consider ourselves different or even better than others? The whole idea is preposterous. This sense of liberation from an illusion difference was such a relief and such a joy to me that I almost laughed out loud. And I suppose my happiness could have taken form in the words, thank God that I am like other men, that I am only a man among others. To think that for 16 or 17 years I have been taking seriously this pure illusion that is implicit in so much of our monastic thinking. I have the immense joy of being man, a member of a race in which God himself became incarnate. As if the sorrows and stupidities of the human condition could overwhelm me, now I realize what we all are, and if only everybody could realize this, but it cannot be explained. There is no way of telling people that they are all walking around shining like the sun. It is because I am one with them that I owe it to them to be alone. And when I am alone, they are not they, but my own self. There are no strangers. Then it was as if I suddenly saw the secret beauty of their hearts, the depths of their hearts, where neither sin nor desire nor self-knowledge can reach, the core of their reality, the person that each one is in God's eyes. If only they could all see themselves as they really are. If only we could see each other that way all the time. There would be no more war, no more hatred, no more cruelty, no more greed. I suppose the big problem would be that we would fall down and worship each other. But this cannot be seen, only believed and understood by a peculiar gift.
I wish I could write that just in my journals, you know, whip it off. Now the seventh and final inductee into the Hall of Fame for 2014. He was prolific. Published 2,000 poems, 460 short stories and more than 60 books. He was born in Greenup County in 1906. He was a son of tenant farmers. He went to Tennessee for college, but returned afterward to his Kentucky home, where he taught school and eventually became the superintendent of schools. All the while, he wrote. His best-known works include his poetry book, Man with a Bull-Tongued Plow, which was published in 1934. He also wrote novels, Trees of Heaven and Taps for Private Tussie, which sold hundreds of thousands of copies in the 1940s. I just learned, he also wrote nonfiction, and I just learned tonight that the very first issue of Playgirl magazine that came out in 1973, included a short story by this inductee. Believe it or not, it also included a short story by Harriet Arnault, one of last year's inductees. There actually were articles in this Playgirl. And there is a copy of that magazine down at the other end of the hall among the many rare books that Dr. James Good has set up for us. I encourage you to go down there before you leave and take a look at the articles in Playgirl. Before his death in 1984, this inductee created a foundation that still operates and bears his name. And the foundation actually is represented tonight by John Zakim, who also happens to be a nephew of the inductee, and he's right here. Our final 2014 inductee tonight is Greenup County's Jesse Stewart. He actually may be good-looking enough to be the centerfold. To read an excerpt tonight from Stewart's work is Georgia Green Stamper. When Georgia moved to Greenup County in 1968, Jesse Stewart was still in relatively good health, and Georgia remembers seeing him at the Greenbow State Park Lodge or signing books at Parsons Department Store in nearby Ashland. She was particularly struck upon learning that he had helped ignite Kentucky's bookmobile movement in the 1950s. And Georgia is a writer herself, and she wrote an essay called Jesse Stewart, The Bookmobile, and Me. And she writes in it, "One of the first of those funny-looking mint-green bread trucks stuffed with books sputtered to a stop in the graveled parking lot of three-room New Columbus grade school. Afterwards, I was never the same. How had Jesse Stewart known how hungry I was for books?" Please welcome Georgia Green Stamper.
Oh, what an honor it is to give voice to a few of Jesse Stewart's beautiful words. But because he wrote so many words, because he was very prolific in multiple genres, I've had a very difficult time, Neil, trying to decide what to read tonight. I finally decided to read a very brief prose scene from his powerful memoir, Beyond Dark Hills, and I'm going to conclude with sonnet number one from The Man with a Bull-Tongued Plow. Just so you people out in the audience know, it's not really very easy to see a page up here. So if I ad-lib one of Jesse Stewart's beautiful words, we'll blame the lighting. How about that? Rent was raised on my father. $12 in cash was too much to pay a month for the use of 100 acres of land and pasture for his cattle. Again, we were ready to go. We had cleared that farm for somebody, and we were ready to move on. We were willing to move away from our neighbors. One house was in sight down the creek from us. We were living too close. "This place is too much like a town to suit me," said my mother. It was true. Our chickens had mixed with our neighbors. Their Plymouth Rocks and our gray games had actually crossed. It was early January when we were getting ready to go. but we were delayed. Herbert, the boy next to me, took down with pneumonia. I recall vividly the January day with a little bit of sun when my father sat on a box under a leafless apple tree. He wrung his hands and said, "It is too unbearable to stand." I recall seeing a spring wagon with a pine box roped to the bed and two mules hitched to it, and then the short train of buggies and wagons that followed. We had to go 5 miles to my grandfather's farm for burial. He was there, his hair white and tousled by the blowing wind. He called to the driver who drove the leading team, "Right this way." The driver drove out across a little field, and all the other teams followed. It was the best way to get to the top of the hill. Grandfather Hilton had cut the wires of his pasture fence. We saw the fresh dirt thrown up near some pine trees. I remember how cold my feet got standing in the mud, and how the people cried. All of the others in the family cried, but I did not. I cried when I went back home, and he was gone. That night at the fireside, Mom said, "Well, I feel free and moving on now. Herbert's buried on land that belongs to my father. He'll not sell it while he lives. It will be part mine by inheritance at his death, and for my part, I shall take the place where the grave is. You know, I just couldn't stand to move on and leave his grave on property owned by other people. It's foolish to be that way, but that's the way I feel. We don't own any land to bury him on, but I can rest tonight knowing that his body lies on my father's soil. We have to move now. I can stand this place no longer." The same spring wagon that hauled my brother away took our furniture on the road again. I led the cows, called the hounds, and later came back for an express load of chickens. "Sir, I am a farmer singing at the plow, and as I take my time to plow along a steep Kentucky hill, I sing my song, a one-horse farmer singing at the plow. I do not sing the songs you love to hear. My basket songs are woven from the words of corn and crickets, trees and men and birds. I sing the strains I know and love to sing. And I can sing my lays like singing corn. I can flute them like a fluting gray cornbird. And I can pipe them like a hunter's horn. All of my life, these are the songs I've heard. And these crude strains no critic can call art. Yours very respectfully, Jesse Stewart."
One more big hand for all the readers. And the inductees. Thank you so much for coming out on this freezing evening.
This presentation of the second annual Kentucky Writers Hall of Fame induction ceremony was recorded at Lexington's Carnegie Center on January 23, 2014. You can hear the entire ceremony, including bonus material not included in this broadcast, at wuky.org/writers. Our thanks to Neil Chethick and the staff of the Carnegie Center for making this broadcast possible. This program was produced by WUKY, University of Kentucky Public Radio. The recording engineer was Chase Cavanaugh. Production assistance was provided by Rusty Sharp. The executive producer was Tom Goodell. Thanks for listening.
Support for this program comes from the Morris Bookshop, proud sponsor of the 2014 Kentucky Writers Hall of Fame induction ceremony broadcast. Morris Bookshop carries books by Hall of Fame authors in-store or online at morrisbookshop.com. And the Pfister Group at Morgan Stanley, 444 East Main Street in Lexington. Investments and services are offered through Morgan Stanley Smith Barney, LLC. Details from Morgan or Justin Pfister at 859-231-9510. Member SIPC.